Are we our bodies? Is a small person less than a big person, then? If we were our bodies, then when we lost an arm or a leg, would we be less? Would we begin to fade from existence? No, we are the same person. We are not our bodies. We are our thoughts. As they form, they define who we are and create the reality of our existence. Between those thoughts, there is nothing, simply the body, waiting for our thoughts to make us who we are. Between your thoughts, I come. In that space between your thoughts, time has no meaning to you, but it has meaning to me. He took a swig of wine. I am a shadow, slipping between the cracks of your existence. Through the link, Ulyssia could feel the others trembling. That isn't possible, she whispered. Your Han can't spread time, break it apart. His condescending smile caught her breath short. A small, simple wedge, inserted into a crack in the largest, most massive boulder, can split it apart, destroy it. I am that wedge. That wedge is now hammered into the cracks in your minds. She stood silently as his thumb gouged off a long strip of pork from a roasted suckling pig. When you sleep, your thoughts float and drift, and you are vulnerable. When you sleep, you are a beacon I can find. Then my thoughts slip into the cracks. The spaces where you fade in and out of existence are chasms to me. And what do you want with us? Armina asked. He tore off a bite of the pork dangling from his meaty fingers. Well, among my uses for you, we have a mutual enemy, Richard Rawl. You know him as Richard Cipher. He arched an eyebrow over one of his dark, seething eyes. The Seeker. Up until now, he's been invaluable. He did me a huge favor by destroying the barrier, which kept me on this side. My body, anyway. You, the Sisters of the Dark, the Keeper, and Richard Rawl, made it possible for me to bring the race of man to ascendancy.
We've done no such thing, Toby protested in a meek voice.
Ah, but you have. You see, the Creator and the Keeper vied for dominance in this world. The Creator, simply to prevent the Keeper from swallowing it into the world of the dead. And the Keeper, simply because he has an insatiable appetite for the living. His inky-eyed gaze rose to meet theirs. In your struggle to free the Keeper, to give him this world, you gave the Keeper power here, and that, in turn, baited Richard Rawl to come to the defense of the living. He restored the balance. In that balance, just as in the space between your thoughts, I come. Magic is the conduit to those other worlds, giving them power here. By reducing the amount of magic in the world, I will lessen the Creator and the Keeper's influence here. The Creator will still send his spark of life, and the Keeper will still take it away when its end has come. But beyond that, the world will belong to man. The old religion of magic will be consigned to the midden heap of history, and eventually to myth. I am a dream walker. I have seen the dreams of men. I know their potential. Magic suppresses these boundless visions. Without magic, man's mind, his imagination, will be unleashed, and he will be all-powerful. That's why I have the army I do. When magic is dead, I will still have them. I keep them well practiced for that day.
And how is Richard Rawl your enemy? Ulyssia asked, hoping to keep him talking while she tried to think of what they could do.
He had to do as he did, of course, or you darlings would have given the world to the Keeper. That aided me. But now he interferes with my plans. He's young and ignorant of his talents. I, on the other hand, have spent the last 20 years perfecting my ability.
He waved the knife point in front of his eyes.
Only in the last year have my eyes turned, the mark of a dreamwalker. Only now am I entitled to the most feared appellation in the ancient world. In the ancient tongue, dreamwalker is synonymous with weapon. The wizards who created this weapon came to regret it.
He licked the grease off his knife as he watched them.
It's a mistake to forge weapons with minds of their own. You are my weapons now. I don't make the same mistake. My power allows me to enter the minds of anyone when they sleep. In those who don't have the gift, I can only exert a limited amount of influence, and they are of small use to me anyway. But in those who are gifted, like you six, I can do anything I wish. Once my wedge is in your mind, it is no longer yours, it's mine. The magic of the Dreamwalkers was powerful, but unstable. None has been born with the ability in the last 3,000 years, since the barrier went up and trapped us here. But now, a Dreamwalker treads this world again. He shook with a menacing chuckle. The tiny braids at the corners of his mouth danced. That would be me. Ulyssia almost told him to get to the point, but stopped herself just in time. She had no desire to see what he would do when he was done talking. She needed the time to try to think of something. How do you know all this? Jagang tore a strip of charred fat from the roast and nibbled on it as he went on. In a buried city in my homeland of Altarang, I found an archive from the ancient times. Ironic, the value of books to a warrior like me. The Palace of the Prophets has books of immense value, too, if you know how to use them. Too bad the prophet died, but I have other wizards.
Jagang continued. A fragment of magic from the ancient war, a shield of sorts, was passed down from its originator to all those descendants with the gift born to the House of Rahl. This bond shields people's minds so I can't enter. Richard Rahl has that ability and has begun to use it. Before he learns too much, he must be brought to task. Along with his betrothed. He paused with a distant, brooding look. The Mother Confessor dealt me a small setback, but she's being brought to task by my unwitting puppets up north. The fools, in their zeal, have created some complications, but I've yet to truly jerk their strings. When I do, they'll jump to my tune. I have that wedge planted deep. I've spent great effort to bend events to my advantage, so as to put Richard Rahl and the Mother Confessor in the palm of my hand. He squeezed a fist of meat from the roasted suckling pig. You see, he's been born a war wizard, the first in 3,000 years, but then you knew that. A wizard like that will prove an invaluable weapon to me. He can do things none of you can, so I don't want to kill him. I want to control him. When he's outlived his usefulness, then he'll need killing. Jagang sucked the pig fat from his rings. You see, control is more important than killing. I could have killed you six, but then what good would you be? As long as you're under my dominion, you're no threat to me, and of use in, oh, so many ways. Jagang turned his wrist up, pointing his knife at Marissa. You've all vowed vengeance against him, but you, my darling, have vowed to bathe in his blood. I may yet give you the chance. Marissa's face paled. How could you know that? I said that when I was awake. He chuckled at the look of panic on her face. If you don't want me to know something, darling, then you shouldn't dream about what you've said while you were awake. Through the link, Ulyssia felt Armina come near to fainting. Of course, you six must first be brought to task. You must learn who it is that's in control of your lives. With his knife, he indicated the silent slaves behind him. You'll become as obedient as these here. For the first time, Ulyssia took a good look at the partially clad people around the room. She nearly gasped aloud. The women were all sisters. Worse, most were her sisters of the dark. She took a quick survey. Not all of them were here. The men, mostly young wizards, who had been released after their training at the palace, were also ones who had given a soul oath to the keeper. Some are sisters of the light and serve well, for fear of what I'll visit upon them should they displease me. With a finger and thumb, Jagang stroked the thin gold chain between the rings in his nose and ear. But I like your sisters of the dark the best. I've brought them all to task, even those at the palace. Ulyssia felt as if another pin had been knocked from under her. I have business at the Palace of the Prophets. Important business. The gold chains at his chest glinted in the firelight as he spread his arms. They're all quite obedient. His inky gaze turned to those behind. Aren't you my darlings? Janet, a sister of the light, kissed her ring finger as tears crept down her cheeks. Jagang laughed. His ring sparkled in the firelight as he pointed a thick finger at her. See that? I permit her to do that. It keeps her filled with false hope.
Would I prevent it, then she might kill herself, because she doesn't have the fear of death like those sworn to the Keeper. Isn't that right, my darling Janet?
Yes, Excellency, she answered in a cowed voice. You own my body in this life, but my soul belongs to the Creator when I die.
Jagang laughed, a morbid, grating sound. Ulyssia had heard it before, and she knew she was going to be its cause again. You see, that's what I tolerate in order to maintain my control. Of course, she will now have to serve a week in the tents as punishment. His inky glare caused Janet to shrink back. But then you knew that before you said it, didn't you, my darling? Sister Janet's voice trembled.
Yes, Excellency.
Jagang's murky, clouded eyes returned to the six before him. I like Sisters of the Dark best because they have sound reason to fear death. He twisted the pheasant in half. Bones snapped and popped. They failed the Keeper, to whom they've sworn their souls. If they die, it's no escape. If they die, the Keeper will have his revenge for their failure. He laughed, a deep, resonant, mocking sound. As he'll have you six, for eternity, if you displease me enough to earn death. Ulysses swallowed.
We understand, Excellency.
Jagang's nightmare gaze made her forget to breathe. Oh, no, Ulyssia. I don't think you truly do. When your lessons are finished, though, you will. With his nightmare gaze on Ulyssia, he reached under the table and dragged a shapely woman out by her blonde hair. She winced in pain as his powerful fist lifted her. She was dressed the same as the others. Through the sheer fabric, Ulyssia could see older yellow bruises and newer purple ones. There was a bruise on her right cheek and a fresh, huge, black-blue one on her left jaw, with a line of four cuts left by his rings. It was Christabel, one of the Sisters of the Dark Ulyssia had left at the palace. The Sisters of the Dark at the palace were to have laid the groundwork for their return. Apparently, they now laid the groundwork for Jagang's arrival. What he could want with the Palace of the Prophets, she couldn't fathom. Jagang turned his hand over, pointing. Stand before me. Sister Christabel scurried around the table to stand before Jagang. She quickly smoothed her disheveled hair and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand before bowing.
How may I serve you, Excellency?
Well, Christabel, I need to teach these six their first lesson. He tore the other leg off the pheasant. In order to do that, you must die. She bowed.
Yes, Excellency.
She froze, realizing what he had just said. Ulyssia could see her legs trembling as she straightened, but still the woman dared say nothing. He gestured with the pheasant leg to the two women sitting before him on the bearskin, and they scrambled away. Jagang smiled that terrifying smirk of his. Goodbye, Christabel. Her arms flung into the air as she collapsed to the ground with a shriek. Christabel thrashed madly on the floor, screamed so loudly it hurt Ulyssia's ears. The six women standing above her at the edge of the bearskin watched with wide eyes, holding their breath. Jagang gnawed on his pheasant leg. The blood-curdling screams went on and on, as Christabel's head whipped from side to side, and her whole body flopped and bounced as she twitched violently. Jagang occupied himself with his pheasant leg and having his wine mug refilled. No one spoke as he finished the leg and turned to take a few grapes. Ulyssia could stand it no longer.
How long until she dies?
She asked in a hoarse voice. Jagang lifted an eyebrow. Until she dies? He threw his head back as he roared in laughter. His fists, bristling with huge rings, pounded the table. No one else in the room so much as smiled. His burly body shook. The thin chain between his nose and ear danced as his laughter died out in fits. She was dead before she hit the floor.
What? But she's still screaming.
Christabel suddenly was silent, her chest as still as stone. She's been dead from the first instant, Jagang said. A slow smile spread on his lips as he fixed the black void of his gaze on Ulyssia. That wedge I told you about, just like the one I have in your minds. What you see is her soul screaming. You are seeing her torment in the world of the dead. The Keeper looks to be displeased with his Sister of the Dark. Jagang lifted a finger, and Christabel resumed her wild thrashing and screaming. Ulyssia swallowed.
How long until she stops?
He licked his lips. Until she rots. Ulyssia felt her knees trembling, and through the link she could feel the other five on the verge of screaming in mad panic.
just as Christabel was. This was the displeasure the Keeper would visit upon them if they didn't restore his influence in this world. Jigang snapped his fingers.
Slith, Eris!
Light shimmered against the wall. Ulyssia gasped as two caped forms seemed to appear out of the dark stone. The two scaled creatures glided silently around the table and bowed.
Yes, Dreamswalker.
Jigang waggled his thick finger, indicating the screaming woman on the floor.
Throw her down the privy pit.
The Mriswith flipped their capes back over their shoulders and bent, lifting the thrashing, shrieking body of a woman Ulyssia had known for well over 100 years, a woman who had helped her and been an obedient servant to the Keeper's wishes. She was to have had a reward for her service. They all were. Ulyssia looked to Jigang as the two Mriswith left the room with their load for the privy pit.
What do you want us to do?
Jigang lifted a hand and with two grease-slicked fingers motioned a soldier at the side of the room to come forward.
These six belong to me. Ring them.
The husky man, draped in furs and hung with weapons, bowed. He went to the closest, Nikki, and with filthy fingers unceremoniously pulled on her lower lip, distending it grotesquely. Her wide blue eyes filled with panic, Ulyssia gasped with Nikki. Through the link she could feel the young woman's stunned pain and terror as the blunt, rusty iron pick stabbed with a twisting motion through the margin of the lip. The soldier stuck the wooden-handled pick back in his belt and pulled a gold ring from his pocket as he held out her lower lip. With the help of his teeth, he spread the split in the ring and then shoved it through the bleeding wound. He twisted the ring around and used his teeth to close the gap. The unshaven, filthy, stinking soldier came to Ulyssia last. By then she was shuddering uncontrollably, having felt it done to each of the others. As he yanked on her lower lip, she desperately tried to think of an escape. It was like drawing a bucket from an empty well. Tears of pain flooded from her eyes as the ring was poked through. Jigang wiped grease from his mouth with the back of his hand while he watched with amusement as blood trickled down all their chins.
You six are my slaves now. If you don't give me cause to kill you, I have use for you at the Palace of the Prophets. When I'm finished with Richard Rawl, I may even let you kill him.
His eyes came up again, the sullen shapes in them shifting in a way that caught her breath. All traces of mirth vanished, leaving unbridled menace in its place.
But first, I'm not finished with your lessons.
We understand quite well our alternatives, Ulyssia said hurriedly. Please, you have no need to fear our loyalty.
Oh, I know that, Jigang whispered. But I still haven't finished with your lessons. Your first one was only the beginning. The rest won't be nearly so quick.
Ulyssia's legs were in danger of giving way. Since Jigang had begun coming into her dreams, her waking life had turned into a nightmare. There must be a way to stop this, but she could think of none. She had a vision of herself returning to the Palace of the Prophets as one of Jigang's slaves in one of those outfits. Jigang glanced past her.
Have you boys been listening?
Ulyssia heard Captain Blake answer that they had. She started. She had forgotten all about the 30 sailors standing behind her at the back of the room. Jigang gestured with two fingers for them to come closer.
In the morning you may leave. I thought, though, that for tonight you would like to have these ladies.
Each of the six went rigid. But her words were cut short by the way the floating shapes shifted suddenly in his murky eyes.
From now on, if you use your magic against my wishes, even if it's to stop yourself from sneezing, you'll share Christabel's fate. In your dreams, I've shown you a small taste of what I can do to you while you're alive, and you've now seen a small taste of what the Keeper will do to you if you die. You have but one path to tread. If I were you, I'd not put one foot wrong.
Jigang returned his gaze to the sailors behind them.
They're yours for the night. Knowing these six from their dreams, I know you have scores to settle. Do to them as you wish.
The sailors' voices rose in gleeful oaths. Through the link, Ulyssia could feel a hand grip Armina's breast. Another pulled Nikki's head back by her hair as the lace at her bodice was pulled loose, and another hand slid up the inside of her own thigh. She choked back a scream.
There's some minor rules, Jigang said, stopping the hands on them. If you violate them, I'll gut you all like a sack of fish.
And what would the rules be, Emperor?
A sailor asked.
You can't kill them. They're my slaves. They belong to me. I want them returned in the morning in good enough condition so that they can serve me.
That means no broken bones and such. You'll draw lots as to which one you get. I know what'll happen if I let you choose for yourselves. I don't want any of them neglected. The sailors all chuckled in agreement, and all spoke up that it was more than fair. They vowed the rules would be followed. Jigang returned his attention to the six women. I have a gigantic army of big, burly soldiers and nowhere near enough whores to go around. Puts my men in an ugly mood. Until I have other duties for you, you'll serve in that capacity for all but 4 hours a day. Be thankful you have my ring in your lip. It'll keep them from killing you while they're having their fun.
Sister Cecilia spread her hands. She glowed with a kindly, innocent smile.
Emperor Jigang, your men are young and strong. I'm afraid they would find no enjoyment being with an old woman such as myself. I'm sorry.
I'm sure they'll grin with delight to have you. You'll see.
Emperor, Sister Cecilia is right. I'm afraid I, too, am too old and fat,
Toby said in her best elderly voice.
We would bring your men no satisfaction.
Satisfaction?
He took a bite of the roast on the point of his knife.
Satisfaction? Are you daft? This has nothing to do with satisfaction. I assure you, my men will enjoy your warm charms. But you misunderstand.
He waggled a finger at them, the greasy rings on his fingers glinting in the firelight.
You six were sisters of the light, and then sisters of the dark. You're probably the most powerful sorceresses in the world. This is to teach you that you're little more than dung beneath my boots. I'll do with you as I please. Those with a gift are my weapons now. This is to teach you a lesson. You have no say in it. Until I decide otherwise, I give you to my men to use. If they want to twist your fingers and take bets on who can make you scream the loudest, then they will. If they want any other sort of pleasure from you, then they'll have it. They have quite varied tastes, and as long as they don't kill you, they're free to indulge them.
He shoved the rest of the piece of meat in his mouth.
After these fellows are done with you anyway. Enjoy my gift, boys. Do as I ask, follow my rules, and I may have use of you in the future. Emperor Jigang treats his friends well.
A cheer for the Emperor went up from the sailors. Eulysia would have fallen when her legs buckled had not an arm circled her waist to pull her back tight against an eager sailor. She could smell his foul breath.
Well, 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 lass. Looks like you ladies are going to come out to play after all, and after you were so nasty to us.
Eulysia could hear herself whimper. Her lip throbbed in pain, but she knew it was only the beginning. She was so stunned by what was happening that she couldn't form a clear thought.
Oh, Jigang said,
stopping everyone. He gestured with his knife to Marissa.
Except that one. You can't have her, he said to the sailors.
He waggled two fingers.
Step forward, darling.
Marissa took two strides to the fur. Through the link, Eulysia could feel her legs trembling.
Christabel was mine exclusively. She was my favorite. But she's dead now, just to serve as a lesson for you.
He glanced to where the sailors had already pulled her dress open.
You will take her place.
He returned his inky gaze to her eyes.
You did say, if I recall correctly, that you would lick my feet if you must. You must.
At Marissa's look of surprise, Jigang smiled that deadly smile of his, framed by the little braids at the ends.
I told you, darling. You dream things you've said when you're awake.
Marissa nodded weakly.
Yes, Excellency. Take off that dress. You might need something nice for later if I choose to let you kill Richard Rawl for me.
He looked to the other women as Marissa did as she was ordered.
I'm going to leave the link on you for now, so you can each feel the lessons the others get. I wouldn't want you to miss out on any of it.
When Marissa had finished, Jigang turned the knife between a finger and thumb and pointed it down.
Under the table, darling.
Eulysia could feel the coarse fur rug against Marissa's knees, and then the rough stone floor under the table. The sailors leered at the sight. Through sheer force of will, from her reservoir of hatred for this man, Eulysia tapped strength and drew resolve. She was the leader of the Sisters of the Dark. Through the link, she spoke to the others.
We have all been through the ritual. Worse than this has been done to us. We are Sisters of the Dark. Remember who is our true master. For now we are slaves to this leech, but he has made a huge mistake if he thinks we don't have minds. He has no power of his own except to use ours. We will think of something, and then Jagang will pay. Oh, sweet master, will he ever pay? But what are we going to do until then? Armina screamed. Silence! Nikki commanded. Ulyssia could feel the probing fingers on Nikki, and she could feel the white heat of her rage, and she could feel her heart of black ice. Remember each face. They will each pay. Listen to Ulyssia. We'll think of something, and then we will teach them all lessons only we could envision. And don't any of you dare dream any of this, Ulyssia warned. The one thing we cannot afford is to let Jagang kill us, or all hope is lost. As long as we live, we have a chance to earn our way back into our master's favor. We've been promised a reward for our souls, and I intend to have it. Have strength, my sisters. But Richard Rawl is mine, Marissa hissed. Any who takes him in my stead will answer to me, and the Keeper. Even Jagang, had he been able to hear her, would have blanched at the venom in her warning. Through the link, Ulyssia felt Marissa push her thick hair back out of the way. She could taste what Marissa tasted. I'm done with you. Jagang paused a moment as he drew a breath. He waved the knife. Begone! Captain Blake snatched Ulyssia by the hair. Time for payback, lass. Chapter 28. She blinked as she looked down the length of the rusty sword held at her face. The point was no more than an inch away. Really, is this necessary? I told you that you could steal what you wanted and we wouldn't do anything to stop you. But I have to tell you that you're the third band of dangerous outlaws who have robbed us in the last couple of weeks, and we've nothing of value left. By the way the lad's hand was shaking, he didn't look to be very practiced at his craft. By the way his skin clung to his bones, he didn't look to be very successful at it either. Be quiet! He snuck a look in the direction of his companion. Have you found anything? The second young outlaw, squatting among the packs in the snow, and as thin as the first, darted glances around at the darkening woods to each side of the little-traveled road. He checked behind, to the bend in the road not far away, where it vanished behind a screen of snow-crusted fir trees. In the center of the bend, just before the road vanished, was a bridge over a stream still rushing despite the fact it was winter. No, just old clothes and junk. No bacon, not even any bread. The first danced back and forth on the balls of his feet, ready to bolt at the first sign of trouble. He brought his other hand up to the hilt to help hold the weight of the poorly made sword. You look well fed. What do you two eat, old woman? Snow? She folded her hands against her belt as she sighed. She was tiring of this. We work for our food as we go. You should try it. Work, I mean. Yeah? It's winter, old woman, in case you hadn't noticed. There's no work. Last autumn the army took our stores. My parents don't have anything to get them through the winter. I'm sorry, son. Perhaps... Hey, what's this, old man? He had his finger through the dull silver collar. He gave it a yank. How do you get this off? Answer me! I told you, she said, avoiding the silent fury of the wizard's blue eyes. My brother is deaf and dumb. He doesn't understand your words, and he can't answer them. Deaf and dumb? Then you tell me. How do you get this thing off? It's just an iron memento that was welded on long ago. It's worthless. A hand came off the sword as her assailant leaned warily toward her, and with a finger lifted her cape aside. What's this? A purse! I found her purse! He yanked the heavy bag of gold coins from her belt. It must be full of gold! She chuckled. I'm afraid it's just a bag of hard biscuits. You're free to have one if you'd like, but don't try to bite down on them or you'll break your teeth. Suck on it a while. He fished out a gold coin and put it between his teeth. He winced with a sour expression. How can you eat these things? I've eaten bad biscuits, but these aren't even good enough to be called bad. So easy with a young mind, she thought. Too bad it wasn't that easy on an adult. He spat to the side and tossed the bag of gold to the snow before patting her cape, searching for anything else she'd have concealed. She sighed impatiently. Would you boys get on with this robbery? We'd like to make the next town before dark. Nothing, the second said. They don't have nothing worth the trouble of carrying off. They got horses, the first said as he squeezed fistfuls of her heavy cape, feeling for anything it might be holding. At least we can take the horses. They'll bring something. Please do, she said. I'm tired of being slowed by leading those old nags around. You would be doing me a favor. All four are lame, and I don't have the heart to put them out of their misery.
The old woman's right,
the second said as he pulled one of the limping horses along, testing it.
All four. We can walk faster. We try to take these bags of bones with us and we'll get caught sure.
The first was still running his hand down her cape. It halted on her pocket.
What's this?
Her voice took on an edge. Nothing of interest to you.
Yeah?
He fingered the journey book from her pocket. As he thumbed through the blank pages, she caught sight of a message. At last.
What's this?
Just a notebook. Can you read, son?
No. It don't appear to be hardly nothing worth reading anyway. Take it anyway,
the second said.
It might be worth something if nothing's written in it.
She looked back to the young man holding the sword on her.
I've had just about enough of this. Consider the robbery over. It's over when I say it's over.
Give it back, Anne said in a level voice as she held her hand out. And then be on your way before I drag you to town by your ear and have your parents come to collect you. He brandished the sword as he leapt back defensively.
Look, don't you go getting feisty, or you'll taste steel. I know how to use this thing.
The still evening air suddenly thundered with horses' hooves. She had been watching as the soldiers had slipped up, around the bend and over the little bridge, unnoticed by the two young men because of the rushing water, until at the last moment when they charged in, as her assailants turned in shock, Anne snatched the sword from his hands, Nathan snatched the knife from the other. Mounted Daharan soldiers suddenly towered above them.
What's going on here? The sergeant asked in a calm, deep voice.
The two young men stood frozen in panic.
Well, Anne said, we ran into these two here, and they were telling us how we should be careful of outlaws. They live in the neighborhood. They were showing us how to protect ourselves and giving us a demonstration of their blade work.
The sergeant folded his hands over the pommel.
Is that right, boy?
His
pleading eyes turned to her.
That's right. We live nearby, and we was just telling these two travelers to be careful, as we heard tell that there are outlaws about.
And quite a show of swordsmanship it was. As I promised, young man, you get a biscuit for the show. Hand me my sack of biscuits there. He bent and snatched up the heavy purse of gold, holding it out to her. Anne pulled two coins out and pressed one into the hand of each young man.
As promised, a biscuit for each. Now, you boys best be getting home before dark, or your parents will worry. Give them my biscuit as thanks for sending you out to warn us to be careful.
He nodded dumbly.
All right. Good night, then. Take care of yourselves.
Anne held her hand out. She fixed the young man with a dangerous squint.
If you're done looking at my notebook, I'll have it back.
His eyes widened at the look in hers, and then he thrust the journey book into her hand as if it were burning his fingers, which it was. Anne smiled.
Thank you, son.
He wiped the hand on his tattered coat.
Goodbye, then, and be careful.
He turned to leave.
Don't forget this.
He turned back cautiously. She held the hilt out to him.
Your father would be awfully angry if you forgot to bring back his sword.
He lifted it carefully. Nathan, not about to let this go without a bit of theatrics, walked the spinning knife across the backs of his fingers. He tossed the knife in the air, catching it behind his back, and then whirled it under his armpit and into his other hand. Anne rolled her eyes as he slapped the blade, reversing the spin. He caught the knife by its blade and handed it, handle first, to the other wide-eyed young man.
Where'd you learn to do that, old man? The sergeant asked.
Nathan scowled. If there was one thing Nathan didn't like, it was being called old man. He was a wizard, a prophet, of unparalleled ability, and thought he should be viewed with wonder, if not open awe. She was restraining his gift by choking it off with his Radahan, or no doubt the sergeant's saddle would be aflame by now. She was also preventing him from speaking. Nathan's tongue was at least as dangerous as his power.
I'm afraid my brother is deaf and dumb.
She gestured to the two outlaws with a shooing motion of her hand. They waved and scrambled for the woods, kicking up snow as they went.
My brother has always amused himself by practicing hand tricks.
Ma'am, are you sure those two aren't causing you any trouble?
Oh, no, she scoffed.
The sergeant lifted his reins, the 20 men behind him doing the same in response, ready to take out after him.
Well, I think we'll have a little talk with them anyway. Little talk about thieving.
If you do, be sure to ask them to tell you about how the Daharan soldiers stole their family's stores of food and how they're starving because of it.
The square-jawed soldier lowered the reins.
I don't know anything about what was done before, but the new Lord Rawl has given explicit orders that there will be no stealing of anything by the army.
The new Lord Rawl?
He nodded. Richard Rawl, the master of Dahara. From the corner of her eye, she saw a smile twitch across Nathan's lips. It was a smile for a properly taken fork in a prophecy. What had to be, were they to succeed, it brought her no smile, but an inner pang of agony for the path ahead now confirmed. Only the alternative was worse.
"Yes, I do believe I have heard the name, now that you mention it."
The sergeant stood in the stirrups and turned back to his men.
"Ogden! Spaulding!"
Their horses kicked up snow and they leaped ahead.
"Go after those boys and take them to their families. Find out if what they say is true about their stores being stolen by troops. If it is, find out the number and their families and if there are any others in the neighborhood under the same circumstances. Take a report back to Aidendrill at once and see to it that they get what they need to eat to see them through the winter."
The two men saluted with a fist to the dark leather and mail over their hearts and then galloped their horses down the tracks leading into the woods. The sergeant turned back to her.
"Lord Rawl's orders," he explained. "Are you headed to Aidendrill?"
"Yes, we're hoping to find safety there, like the others traveling north."
"You'll find it, then, but it comes at a cost. I'll tell you the same as all the others. Whatever your former homeland, you will now be subjects of Dahara. Your allegiance is required, along with a small portion of what you earn in your labor, if you wish to come to territory held by Dahara."
She lifted an eyebrow.
"It would seem the army is still thieving from the people."
"It might seem so to you, but not to Lord Rawl, and his word is law. All pay the same in order to support the troops who have been charged with protecting our freedom. If you don't wish to pay, you are free not to seek that protection and freedom."
"Seems like Lord Rawl has things well in hand."
The sergeant nodded.
"He is a powerful wizard."
Nathan's shoulders shook with a silent laugh. The sergeant's eyes narrowed.
"What's he laughing about? If he's supposed to be deaf and dumb."
"Oh, he is, but he's also a half-wit."
Anne strolled toward the horses. As she crossed in front of the broad-shouldered wizard, she landed a sharp elbow in his gut.
"Laughs like that at the oddest times,"
she scowled up as Nathan coughed.
"He's liable to start drooling in a moment if he keeps at it."
Anne stroked a gentle hand along Bella's sleek, powerful golden flanks. Bella danced with delight at her touch. The big mare hopefully stuck her tongue out. She liked nothing better than having someone tug on it. Anne obliged her and then scratched behind an ear. Bella whinnied with a hoarse giggle and stuck the tongue out again, hoping for the game to continue.
"You were saying, Sergeant, about how Lord Rawl is a powerful wizard?"
"That's right. He slew the creatures you'll see on pikes before the palace."
"Creatures?"
"He calls them Riswith. Ugly, scaled, lizard-like things. They've killed a number of people, but Lord Rawl himself cut them to pieces."
Riswith. That was certainly not good news.
"Is there a town near, where we could find food and lodging for the night?"
"Ten Oaks is just over the next rise, maybe 2 miles. There's a small inn there."
"And how far to Aidendrill?"
He appraised their four horses as she stroked Bella's ear.
"With animals as fine as those, I doubt it will take you more than 7 or 8 days."
"Thank you, Sergeant.
It's good to know there are soldiers about in case there are outlaws in the neighborhood."
He glanced over at Nathan, taking in his towering form, his long white hair that brushed his shoulders, his strong, clean-shaven jaw, and his hooded, penetrating dark azure eyes. Nathan was a ruggedly handsome man filled with vigor, despite the fact that he was close to 1,000 years old. The sergeant looked back to her, clearly preferring to exchange glances with a squat old woman rather than with Nathan. Even with his power choked off, Nathan presented an intimidating presence.
"We're looking for someone, the Blood of the Fold."
"Blood of the Fold? You mean those pompous fools from Nicobarisi in the red capes?"
The sergeant snugged the reins as his horse tried to step sideways. Others of the 20 horses pawed the snow, looking for grass or nibbled hopefully at dry branches to the side of the road, tails lazily swishing the cool evening air.
"That's them. 2 men, one the Lord General of the Blood, another officer, and a woman. They escaped from Aidendrill, and Lord Rawl has ordered them brought back. We have men out everywhere scouring the countryside."
"Sorry, but I haven't seen a sign of them. Is Lord Rawl staying at the Wizard's Keep?"
"No, at the Confessor's Palace."
Anne sighed.
"That's good, at least."
His brow drew together.
"Why is that good?"
She hadn't realized she had spoken her relief out loud.
"Oh, well, it's just that I'm hoping to see this great man, and if he stays at the Keep, then I wouldn't be able to. It's protected by magic, I hear. If he comes out on a balcony at the palace to greet the people, I might get to see him. Well, thank you for your help, Sergeant. I think we best get to Ten Oaks before it gets pitch black. Don't want one of my horses to step in a hole and break a leg."
The sergeant bid her a good night and led his column of men up the road, away from Aidendrill. Only after they were more than out of earshot did she withdraw the block from Nathan's voice. It was difficult to maintain such control for long periods of time, and mentally braced for the inevitable tirade as she started gathering up their packs from the snow. "We best be on our way," she told him. Nathan drew himself up with an imperious scowl.
"You would give gold to robbers. You should have—"
"They were only boys, Nathan. They were hungry.
They tried to rob us,"
Anne smiled as she tossed a pack over Bella.
"You know as well as I that that would not have happened, but I gave them a little more than gold. I don't think they will be trying that again,"
he grunted.
"I hope the spell you put on it burns their fingers to the bone.
Help me with our things. I want to get to the inn. There was a message in the journey book."
Nathan was struck speechless for only an instant.
"Took her long enough. We left her enough hints for a child of 10 to figure it out long before now. We did everything but leave a note pinned to her dress that said, 'By the way, the prelate and the prophet aren't really dead, you dolt.'"
Anne cinched Bella's girth strap tight.
"I'm sure it wasn't as easy for her as you make it out to be. It seems obvious to us only because we knew. She had no reason to suspect. Verna figured it out. That's all that is important,"
Nathan replied with a lofty snort before he finally started helping by gathering up the rest of the packs.
"Well, what did she say?"
"I don't know yet. When we get settled for the night, we'll find out."
Nathan lifted a finger in her direction.
"You pulled the deaf and dumb trick on me again, and you will live to regret it."
She turned an angry scowl on him.
"And if we again come across people and you start yelling that you've been abducted by a mad witch and held prisoner in a magic collar, I'll make you deaf and dumb for real."
Nathan huffed sourly as he went back to work. As he turned to his horse, she saw him smile to himself in satisfaction. By the time they found the inn, and after they had left their horses with a boy at the stable out back, the stars were out and a small winter moon was visible over a distant mountain slope. The wood smoke hugging the ground also carried the aroma of stew. She gave the stable boy a penny to carry in their things. Ten Oaks was a small community, and the inn had only a dozen locals at the few tables, most drinking and smoking pipes over stories of soldiers they had seen and rumored alliances forged by the new Lord Rawl, who not all were sure was really in command of Aidendrill, as was claimed. Others asked them to then explain why the Dharan troops had suddenly become so disciplined, if it wasn't because someone had finally brought them to task. Nathan, wearing high boots, brown trousers, a ruffled white shirt buttoned up over his radahan, an open dark green vest, and a heavy dark brown cape hanging almost to the floor, strolled up to the short counter set before a few bottles and kegs. With a noble air, he flipped his cape back over a shoulder as he settled a boot to the foot rail. Nathan relished wearing clothes other than the black robes he always wore at the palace. He called it playing down. The humorless innkeeper smiled only after Nathan had slid silver his way, and advised that for the high price of lodging it had better include a meal. The innkeeper shrugged and agreed. Before she knew it, Nathan was already spinning a tale that he was a merchant traveling with his mistress while his wife was home raising his 12 strapping sons. The man wanted to know what sort of merchandise Nathan dealt in. Nathan leaned close, lowering his commanding voice, and winked at the man as he told him that it would be safer if he didn't know. The impressed innkeeper straightened and handed Nathan a mug on the house. Nathan toasted the Ten Oaks Inn, the innkeeper, and the patrons before he started for the stairs, telling the innkeeper to bring a mug for his woman when he brought their stew. Every eye in the inn followed him, marveling at the impressive stranger among them. Pressing her lips tight, Anne vowed not to let herself be distracted again, giving Nathan enough time to make up their pretense at being there. It was the journey book that had distracted her. She wanted to know what it said, but she was apprehensive about it too. Something could easily have gone wrong, and one of the Sisters of the Dark could have the book and have discovered the two of them were still alive. They couldn't afford that. She pressed her fingers against a pang in her stomach. For all she knew, the Palace of the Prophets was already in the hands of the enemy. The room was small but clean, with two narrow pallets, a whitewashed stand holding a tin wash basin and chipped ewer, and a square table atop which Nathan set an oil lamp he had carried in from the bracket beside the door. The innkeeper was not far behind with bowls of lamb stew and brown bread, followed by the stable boy with their bags. After both had gone and closed the door, Anne sat and scooted her chair up to the table.
"Well?" Nathan said. Aren't you going to give me a lecture?
No, Nathan, I'm tired.
He flourished a hand.
I thought it only fair in view of the deaf-mute business.
His expression turned dark.
I've been held in this collar all but the first 4 years of my life. How would you feel being a captive your whole life?
Anne mused to herself that, being his keeper, she was nearly as much a captive as he. She met his glare.
Though you never believe me when I say it, Nathan, I will tell you again that I wish it weren't so. It brings me no pleasure to keep one of the Creator's children a prisoner for no crime but his birth.
After a long silence, he withdrew the glare. His hands clasped behind his back, Nathan strolled the room, giving it a critical appraisal. His boots thumped across the plank floor.
Not what I'm accustomed to, he announced to no one in particular.
Anne pushed away the bowl of stew and set the journey book on the table, staring at the black leather cover for a time before finally opening it and turning to the writing.
You must first tell me the reason you chose me the last time. I remember every word. One mistake, and this journey book feeds the fire.
My, 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 she murmured. She's being very cautious. Good.
Nathan peered over Anne's shoulder as she pointed.
Look at the strokes, at how hard she pressed. Verna looks to be angry.
Anne stared at the words. She knew what Verna meant.
She must really hate me,
Anne whispered, as the words on the page wavered in her watery gaze. Nathan straightened.
So what? I hate you, and it never seems to bother you.
Do you, Nathan? Do you really hate me?
His only answer was a dismissive grunt.
Have I told you that this plan of yours is madness?
Not since breakfast.
Well, it is, you know.
Anne stared at the words in the journey book.
You've worked before to influence which fork is taken in prophecy, Nathan, because you know what can happen down the wrong path, and you also know how vulnerable the prophecies are to corruption.
What good will it do, everyone, if you get yourself killed with this foolhardy plan, and me with you? I'd like to live to see 1,000, you know. You're going to get us both killed.
Anne rose from her chair. She laid a gentle hand on his muscular arm.
Tell me then, Nathan, what would you do? You know the prophecies. You know the threat. You yourself are the one who warned me. Tell me what you would do, if it were up to you.
He shared a gaze with her for a long moment. The fire left his eyes as he put a big hand over hers.
The same as you, Anne. It's our only chance. But it doesn't make me feel any better knowing the danger to you.
I know, Nathan. Are they there? Are they in Adendrill?
One is, he said quietly as he squeezed her hand. And the other will be there around the time we arrive. I have seen it in the prophecy. Anne, this age that is upon us is tangled with the warren of prophecies. War draws prophecies like dung draws flies. Branches go in every direction. Every one of them must be negotiated properly. If we take the wrong path on any of them, we walk into oblivion. Worse, there are gaps where I don't know what must be done. Worse yet, there are others involved who must also take the correct fork, and we have no control over them.
Anne could find no words, and so nodded instead. She sat back at the table and inched her chair close. Nathan straddled the other chair and broke off a chunk of brown bread, chewing while he watched her draw the stylus from the spine of the journey book. Anne wrote,
"Tomorrow night, when the moon is up, go to the place you found this."
She closed the book and returned it to a pocket in her gray dress. Nathan spoke around his mouthful of bread.
"I hope she is smart enough to justify your faith."
"We trained her as best we could, Nathan. We sent her away from the palace for 20 years, so she might learn to use her wits. We have done all we can. Now we must have faith in her."
Anne kissed the finger where the prelate's ring had been all those years.
"Dear Creator, give her strength too."
Nathan blew on a spoonful of hot stew.
"I want a sword," he announced.
Her brow wrinkled.
"You're a wizard with full command of his gift. Why in the name of creation would you want a sword?"
He regarded her as if she were witless.
"Because I would look dashing with a sword at my hip."
Chapter 29.
"Please,"
Catherine whispered. Richard stared into her soft brown eyes as he gently touched the side of her radiant face, brushing a black ringlet back from her cheek. When they looked into each other's eyes, it was near to impossible for him to look away unless she did so first. He was having that difficulty now. Her hand on his waist sent warm sensations of longing coursing through him. He struggled desperately to put an image of Kaylin in his mind in order to resist the compulsion to take Catherine in his arms and say yes. His body burned to do so. "I'm tired," he lied. Sleep was the last thing he wanted. "It's been a long day. Tomorrow we'll be together again."
"But I want..."
He touched her lips to silence her. He knew that if he heard those words from her again, it would be one time too many. The implied offer of her lips as they sucked the end of his finger with a wet kiss was nearly as impossible to resist as the overt invitation of her words. In the fog of his mind, he could hardly form coherent thoughts. He managed to form one. "Dear spirits, help me. Give me strength. My heart belongs to Kaylin." "Tomorrow," he managed.
"You said that yesterday, and it took me hours to find you,"
she whispered as she kissed his ear. Richard had been using the Mriswith cape to make himself invisible. It was just a little easier to resist when she couldn't appeal to him directly, but it only delayed the inevitable. When he saw her frantic to find him, he couldn't bear to see her in distress as she searched for him, and would end up going to her. As her hand came up to his neck, he took it and administered it a quick kiss. "Sleep well, Catherine. I'll see you in the morning." Richard glanced to Egan standing 10 feet away, with his back to the wall and his arms folded as he stared ahead as if he saw nothing. Beyond, in the shadows at the end of the gloomy hall, Verdine stood guard too. She made no pretense at not seeing him standing at the door with Catherine pressed up against him. She observed without expression. His other guards, Ulick, Kara, and Reyna, were getting some sleep. Richard slipped a hand behind his back and turned the doorknob. His weight against the door caused it to spring open, and as it did, he stepped aside and Catherine stumbled into her room. She caught herself by his hand. Looking into his eyes, she kissed his hand, his knees nearly buckled. Knowing he could resist her no longer if he didn't remove himself from the sight of her, he took back his hand. He was mentally making excuses to himself as to why it would be all right to give in. What could it hurt? Why was it so bad? Why did he think it would be wrong? It felt like there was a thick blanket over his thoughts, suffocating them before they could get to the surface. Voices in his head tried to rationalize why he should stop this foolish resistance and simply enjoy the charms of this gorgeous creature who was making it more than stone-cold obvious that she wanted him, who in fact was begging him. He felt a lump in his throat at his desire for her. He was near tears from struggling to find reasons to stop himself. His thinking churned in a mental stupor. Part of him, the largest part, desperately struggled to make him abandon his resistance, but a small, dim part of his mind fought fiercely, trying to hold him back, trying to warn him that something was wrong. It made no sense. What could be wrong? Why was it wrong? What was it in him that was trying to stop him? "Dear spirits, help me." An image of Kaylin came to him, and he saw her smile that smile she gave no other but him. He saw her lips moving. She said she loved him.
"I need to be alone with you, Richard," Catherine said. "I can't wait any longer."
"Good night, Catherine. Sleep well. I'll see you in the morning." He pulled the door closed. Panting with exhaustion at the effort, he closed the door to his room after he entered. His shirt was soaked with sweat. With a weak arm, he reached up and shoved the bolt to the door into place. It broke as he drove it home. He stared at the bracket as it swung, hanging by one screw. In the dim light coming from the fire in the hearth, he couldn't see the other screws on the ornate carpets. He was so hot he could hardly breathe. Richard pulled the baldric over his head and dropped his sword to the floor on his way to the window. With the effort of a drowning man, he twisted the latch and threw the window open, gasping as if he couldn't get his breath. Cold air filled his lungs, but did little to cool him. His room was on the ground floor, and he briefly contemplated stepping over the sill and rolling in the snow. He decided against it, and settled on letting the cold air waft over him as he stared out into the night at the moonlit, secluded garden. Something was wrong, but he couldn't make himself grasp it. He wanted to be with Catherine, but something inside was fighting it. Why? He couldn't understand why he would want to fight his desire for her. He thought again about Kaylin. That was why. But if he loved Kaylin, why would he be having such an intense desire for Catherine? He could think of little but her. He was having trouble keeping the memory of Kaylin in his head. Richard shuffled to the bed. He instinctively knew that he had reached the end of his ability to resist his lust for Catherine. He sat on the edge of the bed in a daze as his head spun. The door opened. Richard looked up. It was her. She was wearing something so sheer that the dim light in the hall silhouetted her body underneath. She crossed the room toward him.
"Richard, please,"
she said in that soft voice that paralyzed him.
"Don't send me away this time, please. I will die if I can't be with you right now."
Die? Dear spirits, he didn't want her to die. Richard nearly burst into tears at the very thought. She glided closer into the firelight. A softly pleated nightdress reached the floor, but did nothing to hide what was beneath it, merely softening her body into a vision of beauty beyond anything he could have imagined. The sight ignited him. He could think of nothing but what he was seeing and how much he wanted her. If he didn't have her, he would die of unrealized desire. As she stood over him, with one hand behind her back, she smiled as she stroked his face with the other. He could feel the heat of her flesh. She bent and brushed her lips against his. He thought he would die of pleasure. Her hand went to his chest.
"Lie down, my love,"
Catherine whispered as she pushed him back. He flopped back on the bed, staring up at her through the numb agony of desire. Richard thought of Kaylin. He was powerless. Richard dimly remembered some of the things Nathan had told him about using his gift. It was within him, and the anger could bring it out, but he felt no anger. Instinct was how a war wizard used his gift, Nathan had told him. He remembered abandoning himself to that instinct when he was about to die at the hands of Liliana, a sister of the dark. He had given sanction to the inner power. He had let his instinctive use of need bring the power to life. Catherine put a knee on the bed.
"At long last, my love."
In helpless abandon, Richard gave himself over to that calm center, the instinct beyond the veil within his mind. He let himself fall into that dark void. He relinquished control of his actions to what would be. He was lost either way. Clarity ignited, scorching the fog away in seething ripples. He looked up to see a woman for whom he had no feelings. With cold lucidity, he understood. Richard had been touched by magic before. He knew its feel. The shroud had been shattered. There was magic about this woman. With the fog gone, he could feel its cold fingers in his mind. But why? Then he saw the knife. The blade glinted in the firelight as she lifted it over her head. With a wild rush of strength, he flung himself to the floor as Catherine buried the knife in the bedding. She drew it back again as she dove toward him. It was too late for her now. He cocked his legs to kick her back, but in a confusion of sensations and realizations, Richard felt the presence of a Mriswith, and at nearly the same time, he saw it materialize as it dove through the air above him. And then the world went red. He felt warm blood splatter his face as he saw the filmy nightdress slashed open. Severed edges of diaphanous material fluttered, as if in a blast of wind. The three blades ripped Catherine nearly in two. The Mriswith crashed to the floor beyond. Richard spun out from underneath her and sprang to his feet as she toppled back, the shocking gore of her insides sloshing across the carpet. Her terrible gasps died out in heaving pants. Richard crouched, his feet and his hands spread, facing the Mriswith on the other side of her. The Mriswith had a three-bladed knife in each claw. Between them, Catherine writhed in the agony of death. The Mriswith took a step back toward the window, its beady eyes staying on Richard. It took another step, drawing its black cape over one scaled arm as its gaze swept the room. Richard dove for his sword. He slid to a stop as the Mriswith planted a clawed foot atop the scabbard, holding it to the floor.
"No,"
it hissed.
"She was going to kill you."
"Same as you."
"No, I protect you, skin brother."
Dumbfounded, Richard stared up at the dark shape. The Mriswith flung the cape around itself and dove through the window into the night, vanishing as it leapt. Richard lunged toward the window to grab it. His arms caught only air as he landed across the windowsill, hanging halfway out into the night. The Mriswith was gone. He could no longer feel its presence in his mind. In the emptiness left by the departure of the Mriswith, Richard's mind filled with the mental image of Catherine squirming in a mass of her guts. He vomited out the window. When his racking heaves finished and his head stopped spinning, he staggered back to where she lay to kneel beside her. He thanked the spirits that she was dead and no longer suffered. Even if she had tried to kill him, he couldn't stand to watch her suffering in the throes of death. He stared at her face. He couldn't imagine the feelings he had had for her that he now only dimly remembered. She was just an ordinary woman, but she had been shrouded in magic. It was some sort of spell that had overpowered his reason. He had come to his senses with no time to spare. His gift had broken the spell. The top half of her slashed nightdress was thrown up around her neck. A cold feeling that gave him goosebumps turned his attention to her breasts. Richard's eyes narrowed, and he leaned closer, staring. He reached out and touched her right nipple. He touched the left. It wasn't the same. He carried a lamp to the fire and lit it with a long splinter of kindling. He returned to the body and held the lamp near her left breast. Richard wet his thumb on his tongue and rubbed the smooth nipple. It came off. With her nightdress, he cleaned the paint from her breast to leave a smooth, unbroken mound of skin. Catherine had no left nipple. The calm center within radiated an aura of comprehension. This was connected to the spell she had over him. He didn't know how, but it was. Richard suddenly sat back on his heels. He sat a moment, wide-eyed, and then sprang up, running to the door. He stopped. Why should he be thinking this? He had to be wrong. But if he wasn't? He opened the door just enough to slip through and then shut it behind himself. Egan glanced his way, his arms still folded, and resumed his stance. Richard peered down the hall to Berdine, in her red leather, leaning against the wall. She was watching him. Richard crooked his finger, gesturing her to come to him. She straightened and then strolled up the hall. Berdine glanced to the door as she stopped before him. She frowned up to his eyes. "The Duchess wishes to be with you. Go back to her. Go get Kara and Raina, and the three of you get back here." His voice took on the heat of his glower. "Right now. Is something right now." She looked to the door again and then strode off without further word. When she had disappeared around the hall at the end of the corridor, Richard turned to Egan, who was again watching him. "Why did you let her come into my room?" Egan's brow wrinkled in puzzlement. He lifted a hand toward the door.
"Well, the way she is dressed. She said you wanted her tonight, and that you told her to put that on and come to you."
Egan cleared his throat.
"It was obvious why you wanted her. I thought you would be angry if I kept her from you after you had told her to come to you in the night."
Richard turned the knob and flung open the door. He held his arm out in invitation. Egan hesitated and then entered. He stiffened as he stood over her remains.
"Lord Rawl, I'm sorry. I saw no Mriswith. I would have stopped it if I had, or at least have tried to warn you. I swear."
He groaned.
"Dear spirits, what a way to die. Lord Rawl, I failed you."
"Look in her hand, Egan." He glanced along the length of her arm to see the knife still clutched in her fist.
"What the?"
"I didn't ask her to come to me. She came to my room to kill me." Egan's eyes turned away. He clearly knew the implications. Any past Lord Rawl would execute a guard for such a failure.
"She fooled me too, Egan. It's not your fault. But don't you ever let a woman other than my future wife into my room again, understand? If a woman comes to my room, you get my permission to let her in, no matter what."
He clapped a fist to his heart.
"Yes, Lord Rawl."
"Egan, please roll her up in that carpet and get her out of here. Put her in her room for now. Take up your post in the hall, and when the three Mordsith return, send them in." Without questioning the instructions, Egan bent to the task. With his strength and size, it was only a minor effort. After he had inspected the broken door bolt, Richard pulled out a chair from the table and turned it around next to the fireplace and sat facing the door. He hoped he was wrong. What was he going to do if he wasn't? He sat in the quiet, listening to the fire crackle, and waited for the three women. "Come," he called out in response to the knock. Kara entered, followed by Raina, both in their brown leather, with Berdine bringing up the rear. The first two glanced about casually as they crossed the room. Berdine swept the room with a more focused search. The three came to a halt before him.
"Yes, Lord Rawl?" Kara asked without emotion. "You wish something?"
Richard folded his arms.
"Show me your breasts, all three of you."
Kara's mouth opened to say something, but she closed it, and setting her jaw, started undoing the buttons, running up the side of her ribs. Raina glanced to Kara and saw that she was doing as ordered. Reluctantly at first, she started undoing the buttons too. Berdine watched the other two. Slowly, she started slipping the buttons at the side of her red leather outfit. When finished, Kara gripped the top of the leather at the side but didn't open it. Smoldering resentment settled in her expression. Richard rearranged the unsheathed sword in his lap and crossed his legs.
"I'm waiting," he said.
Kara took a final breath of resignation and pulled the front of her outfit open. In the flickering light coming from the recently stoked fire in the hearth, Richard studied each nipple and the wavering shadow cast by each raised knob in the center. Both had the proper contour of flesh and not the flat profile of paint put there to mimic. He shifted his gaze to Raina in silent command. He said nothing as he waited. He could see her fighting to keep silent, and at the same time fighting to decide what to do. She pressed her lips tight in indignation, but finally reached up and yanked the leather aside. Richard gave her breasts the same careful appraisal. Her nipples, too, were both real. His gaze slid to Berdine. She was the one who had threatened him. She was the one who had lifted her Ajeel to him. It wasn't humiliation, but rage that had her face as red as her outfit.
"You said we didn't have to do this. You promised us. You said you would not show me."
Kara and Reyna shifted their weight uncomfortably, not liking this one bit, as if they expected he was choosing one of them for the night. But at the same time, neither was willing to do anything to go against the wishes of the Lord Rawl. Still, Berdine didn't move. He hardened his glare. "That's an order. You are sworn to obey me. Do as I say." Tears of anger leaked from her eyes. She reached up and tore the leather aside. She had only one nipple. Her left breast was smooth and unbroken, her chest heaved with ire. The other two stared at her smooth left breast in open astonishment. By the looks in their faces, Richard knew they had seen her breasts before. When their Ajeel suddenly spun into their fists, he knew that this wasn't what they had expected to see this time. Richard came to his feet, addressing Kara and Reyna. "Forgive me for doing that to you." He gestured for all of them to cover themselves. Berdine stood shaking in rage, not moving, as the other two began to button their leather up the side.
"What's going on?"
Kara asked him, her dangerous eyes on Berdine the whole time she worked at the tight buttons.
"I'll tell you later. You two may leave." "We're not going anywhere," Reyna said in a grave tone as her eyes too stayed on Berdine.
"Yes, you are." Richard pointed toward the door. He lifted a finger to Berdine.
"You stay right there."
Kara stepped protectively closer to him.
"We're not. Don't argue with me. I'm not in the mood. Out!"
Kara and Reyna flinched back in surprise. With a final furious sigh, Kara motioned to Reyna and left the room, closing the door behind them. Berdine's Ajeel spun up into her fist.
"What did you do with her?"
"Who did this to you, Berdine?" he said in a gentle voice. She stepped closer.
"What did you do with her?"
Richard, his mind now clear, could feel the spell around her as she put herself close to him. He could feel the distinctive tingle of magic, its uncomfortable prickling sensation in his gut. This was not benevolent magic. In her eyes, he could see more than magic. He could see the fury of a Mordasith unleashed.
"She died trying to kill me." "I knew I should have done it myself."
She shook her head in disgust.
"Kneel," she commanded through gritted teeth.
"Berdine, I'm not." She lashed out with her Ajeel, striking him across the shoulder, knocking him back.
"Don't you dare address me by my name."
She had been faster than he had expected. He gasped with the pain as he clutched his shoulder. Every memory of an Ajeel being used against him came stunningly fresh to his mind. He was abruptly flushed with doubt. He didn't know if he could do this, but his only alternative was to kill her, and he had sworn he wouldn't do that. The bone-burning torture searing through his shoulder made his resolve falter. Berdine stalked closer.
"Pick up your sword."
He stiffened his will as he regained his feet. Berdine laid the Ajeel on his shoulder, forcing him to his knees. He struggled to maintain his focus. Dinna had taught him to endure this. He must now. He picked up the sword and staggered to his feet again.
"Try to use it on me," she commanded.
Richard looked to her cold blue eyes, fighting the tug of panic within his soul.
"No."
He tossed the sword on the bed.
"I am the Lord Rawl. You are bonded to me."
She screamed in fury as she drove the Ajeel into his gut. The room spun as he realized he was on his back. Breathless, he again struggled to his feet when she commanded it.
"Use your knife! Fight me!"
With shaking fingers, Richard pulled his knife from the sheath at his belt and held it hilt first to her.
"No. Kill me, if that's what you really want."
She snatched the knife from his hand.
"You make this easy for me. I intended to make you suffer. But your death is all that is required."
Richard, his insides in an agony of lingering, burning pain, used all his strength to put his chest out. He pointed.
"Here is my heart, Berdine. The Lord Rawl's heart. The Lord Rawl you are bonded to."
He tapped his chest again.
"Stab me here, if you wish to kill me."
She gave him a gruesome smile.
"Fine. You shall have your wish." "No, not my wish. Yours." "I don't want you to kill me."
She faltered. Her brow twitched.
"Protect yourself," No, Berdine. If this is what you wish, then you must choose it for yourself.
Fight me!
She struck him across the face with the Aegil. It felt like his jaw shattered and all his teeth were knocked out. The pain stabbed into his ear, nearly blinding him with hurt. Panting in a cold sweat, he straightened.
Berdine, you have two magics in you. One is your bond to me. The other is what was put there when they took your nipple. You cannot continue to carry both. One has to be broken. I'm your Lord Rawl. You are bonded to me. The only way you can kill me is to break that bond. My life is in your hands.
She lunged at him. He felt the back of his head smack against the floor. Berdine was atop him, screaming in fury.
Fight me, you bastard!
She pounded his chest with one fist as she held the knife up in the other. Tears streamed from her eyes.
Fight me! Fight me! Fight me!
No. If you want to kill me, then you have to do it on your own.
Fight me!
She struck his face.
I can't kill you if you don't fight me. Defend yourself!
Richard enfolded her in his arms and pulled her to his chest. He pushed his heels against the carpet and slid himself back, taking her with him as he sat up against the bed.
Berdine, just as you are bonded to me, I protect you. I won't let you die like this. I want you alive. I want you as my protector.
No!
She screamed.
I must kill you. You must fight me so I can. I can't do it unless you try to kill me. You must!
Weeping in angry exasperation, she pressed the knife against his throat. Richard did nothing to stop her. He drew his hand down her wavy brown hair.
Berdine, I've sworn to fight to protect those who want to live free. That's my bond to you. I won't do anything to harm you. I know you don't want to kill me. You've sworn on your life to protect me.
I'll kill you. I will. I'll kill you.
I believe in you, Berdine, in your oath to me. I put my life in your word and your bond.
She gasped in racking sobs as she looked into his eyes. She shook as she wept uncontrollably. Richard didn't move against the sharp blade at his throat.
Then you must kill me, she cried. Please. I can stand it no longer. Please, kill me.
I will never do anything to harm you, Berdine. I've given you your freedom. You are answerable to yourself.
Berdine let out a long wail of misery and then threw the knife across the floor. She collapsed against him, throwing her arms around his neck.
Oh, Lord Rawl, she sobbed. Forgive me, forgive me. Oh, dear spirits, what have I done?
You have proven your bond, he whispered as he held her.
They hurt me, she wept. They hurt me so much. Nothing ever hurt like that before. It hurts so to fight it now.
He held her tight.
I know, but you must fight it.
She put a hand to his chest and pushed back.
I can't.
Richard didn't think he had ever seen anyone in such misery.
Please, Lord Rawl, kill me. I can't stand the pain. I beg you, please, kill me.
Richard, in an agony of empathy for her suffering, drew her back to his chest and hugged her, stroking her head, trying to comfort her. It did no good. She only cried harder. He set her back against the bed as she shook and wept. Without thinking about what he was doing or even understanding the reason, he cupped his hand over her left breast. Richard sought the calm center, the place without thought, the fount of peace within, and cloaked himself in instinct. He felt the searing pain seep through him, her pain. He felt what had been done to her, and what the lingering magic was doing to her now. As he had done with the pain of the Aegil, he endured it. In his empathy, he felt the torment of her life, the torture of what it meant to become a Mord Sith, an anguish of her former self lost. His eyes closed, he took it unto himself. Though he didn't see the events involved, he understood the trail of scars they left through her soul. He hardened his will in order to endure the suffering of it. He stood, a rock, in a torrent of hurt rushing into his own soul. He was that rock for her. He let his loving regard for this innocent, this fellow victim of suffering flow into her. Without fully understanding the feelings he was having, he let his instinct guide him. He felt himself soaking up her suffering so that she wouldn't have to endure it, so he could help her, and at the same time he felt an inner warmth flowing outward through his hand on her flesh. Through that hand it seemed he was connected to her spark of life, to her soul. Berdine's crying slowed, her breathing evened out, and her muscles went slack as she sank back against the bed. Richard felt the pain that had come into him from her begin to dissipate. Only then did he realize he was holding his breath with the agony of it, and let the breath go. The warmth flowing from within him began to fade too, and at last was gone. Richard removed his hand and brushed her wavy hair back from her face. Her eyes came open, her dazed, blue-eyed gaze meeting his. They both looked down. She was whole again.
"I'm myself again," she whispered. "I feel as if I have just awakened from a nightmare."
Richard pulled the red leather up across her breasts, covering her.
"Me too."
"There has never been a Lord Rawl such as you before," she said in wonder. "Spirits be praised, there never has."
"Greater truth has never been spoken,"
a voice behind said. Richard turned to see the tear-stained faces of the other two women kneeling behind him.
"Are you all right, Berdine?"
Kara asked. Berdine, still looking a bit stunned, nodded.
"I am myself again."
None of them was as stunned as Richard.
"You could have killed her,"
Kara said.
"If you had tried to use your sword, she would have had your magic, but you could have used your knife. For you, it would have been easy. You didn't have to suffer her Aegil. You could have just killed her."
Richard nodded.
"I know. But that pain would have been worse."
Berdine tossed her Aegil to the floor before him.
"I give this over to you, Lord Rawl."
The other two pulled the gold chains down over their hands and dropped their Aegil to the floor along with Berdine's.
"I, too, give mine over to you, Lord Rawl," Kara said.
"And I, Lord Rawl."
Richard stared at the red rods on the floor before him. He thought about his sword and how much he hated the things he did with it, how he hated the killing he had done with it and the killing he knew he would do again. But he could not yet give up the sword.
"This means more to me than you can know," he said, unable to meet their eyes. "That you would do this is what matters. It proves your hearts and your bond. Forgive me, all of you, but I must ask you to keep them for now."
He handed back their Aegil.
"When this is over, when we are free of the threat, then we can all give up the phantoms that haunt us. But for now we must fight for those who count on us. Our weapons, terrible as they are, allow us to continue the struggle."
Kara laid a gentle hand to his shoulder.
"We understand, Lord Rawl. It shall be as you say. When this is over, we can be free of not only those enemies from without, but within, too."
Richard nodded. "Until then, we must be strong. We must be the wind of death." In the silence, Richard wondered what Mriswith were doing in Adendril. He thought about the one that had killed Catherine. It was protecting him, it had said.
Protecting him? Impossible.
As he thought about it, though, he couldn't recall a Mriswith actually attacking him personally. He remembered the first attack, outside the Confessor's palace, with Gratch. Gratch had attacked them, and Richard had come to the aid of his friend. They had been intent on killing Green Eyes, as they had called the Gar, but they never specifically attacked him. The one tonight had had the best chance of all. Richard had been without his sword, yet it didn't attack him, and instead escaped without a fight. It had addressed him as Skin Brother. Just to wonder what that could mean gave him goosebumps. Richard idly scratched his neck. Kara rubbed a finger on the backside of his neck where he had just scratched.
"What's this?"
"I don't know. Just a spot that's always itching." Chapter 30 Verna paced indignantly back and forth in the little sanctuary. How dare Prelate Annalena do this? Verna had told her that she had to tell her the words so as to prove it was really her, to say once again that she regarded Verna as an unremarkable sister of little note. Verna wanted the prelate to say those cruel words again so she would know that Verna knew she was being used, and of little value to the palace in the prelate's eyes. If she was going to be used and follow the prelate's orders like an earnest sister was duty-bound to do, it would be knowingly this time. Verna was done weeping. She was not going to jump whenever that woman cavalierly crooked a finger. Verna had not devoted her entire life to being a sister of the light, worked so hard for so many years, to be treated with such disrespect. The thing that made her the most angry was that she had done it again. Verna had told the prelate that she first had to say the words to prove it was really her, or Verna would feed the journey book to the fire. Verna had set the rules. Prove yourself first. Instead, the prelate had crooked her finger and Verna had jumped.